Before we start, I meant to mention that we're going to take the full hour today, but I don't want to run over. Now, if you want to ask a question, share a comment, that adds on to our hour. All right? So make it good. I almost asked that we not have any comments or questions this morning, but I'm not going to do that because this is a chapter 19 in Genesis, that generates so many questions that I have. But let's just jump in. Genesis chapter 19. Now, this chapter is the chapter about Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain. Now, as we get into the chapter, I want us to start with this passage. In 2 Peter 2, verses 6 to 8, this is what Peter writes. And he, God, condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter. And if he rescued, now you ready for this? Righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men. For by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. Three times, Peter refers to Lot as righteous. And the sages say, yeah, he was righteous. But they can't figure out one single righteous thing he did. They all argue and strive and try to figure out, they try to stretch this. Well, this is kind of righteous. And over here, well, he could have done worse. Could have been worse, you know. But as far as being a righteous man, you really have to scrape to find some little morsel of righteousness that he did. In fact, pretty much everything Lot did was dead wrong. Which makes me ask a couple of questions. First of all, why does the Bible call Lot righteous? Second of all, how does the Bible really define righteousness? And this is the really tough question. You know, if you just ask me in the world of people, in the physical realm, what is righteousness? I can describe righteousness. But when it comes from God's point of view, I don't quite get it. I really don't quite get it. Because there are some people who are righteous men who we don't see called righteous, but others like Lot, who's called righteous three times here by Peter. Kind of confusing. So, as we go through here, through this chapter, see if you can find something righteous that Lot did. Chapter 19, start with verse 1. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. Okay, stop right there. What does that remind you of? What does that sound like that we've read? Where have you heard words similar to this before? How about the previous chapter? Go back to chapter 18, the first verse. Adonai appeared to him, to Abraham, in the plains of Mamre, while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. We're told who appeared to who at the entrance, in this case a tent in chapter 19, the gates of the city, and what time of day it was. There's a signal. God is telling us through his spirit and in these words of Torah to take the two chapters and lay them side by side. So we have three angels. It actually says Adonai appeared to him, but in the form of three angels, he appears to Abraham. Now two of these angels are called angels here for the first time, appear to Lot. Abraham's sitting in the entrance of his tent way up on the mountain. And then these two appear to Lot sitting in the gates of the city. Now the gates of the city are a position of prestige. Legal transactions and all kinds of things took place in the gates of a city. But it's kind of futile to see someone sitting in a place of prestige in a city that's about to be condemned and destroyed. I think so many times we pursue positions of prestige and honor in a place that's about to be destroyed. So as you go through here, I want you to be thinking back and forth between the previous chapter and this one. Now Lot saw and stood up to meet them, and he bowed face to the ground. What did Abraham do when he saw the angels coming? He ran to them. As soon as he saw them on the horizon, he's off. He's rushing over to them. Lot doesn't do that. He sees them, he stands up, but he waits for them to come to him. And he said, "Behold now, my lords, turn about, please, to your servant's house. Spend the night and wash your feet." Now that's backwards, isn't it? You wash your feet first. That's the very first thing. And Abraham, when he saw the guests, first thing he says, wash your feet. But it's almost like Lot is a bit befuddled. Oh, spend the night. Because his first thing is, this is not a safe place for you to be. In fact, I shouldn't be here myself. But you definitely shouldn't be here. So come spend the night at my house. Oh, then we'll wash your feet. And then he says, wash your feet, then wake up early and go on your way. Why? That doesn't sound very friendly. Hey, can I come for a visit? Yeah, as long as you leave early. But why does Lot do this? Because he realizes you need to get out of here before the sun comes up, because when people see you, it's going to be very dangerous. So hurry, get to my house, we'll take care of things there, then get out of here. And they said, no, rather we will spend the night in the square. Because that was a common thing for passers-by to come. They'd come to the city and they'd be at the town square, and people just camp out in the square, just sleep with a blanket over. And he urged them very much. Now, did Abraham have to urge his guests to stay with him? Not a bit. He asked them one time, and they said, sure, go ahead, do what you said you're going to do. So they turned toward him and came to his house. He made a feast for them. What was his feast? Matzahs, unleavened bread. He's making this in a hurry. He calls it a feast. He gives them unleavened bread. Now, unleavened bread, it can be all right, but you really got to doctor it up. Yeah, I put a lot of butter and chocolate on it, you know. But when you go back to Abraham, he says, let me bring a morsel of bread for you. And what does he bring? He brings them loaves of bread. He brings them milk, maybe some kind of cheese. He has the fatted calf or a lamb killed right away. He brings the best lamb in his flock. He puts on a feast. I'll bring you a morsel of bread and lays out this feast. Lot says, I'm going to bring you a feast, but here's some matzah. See the differences? I mean, as you go through here, you can come up with a whole page of contrast. We don't have time to do it this morning. We have other things to get to. But something you can do for your own homework. But this is the first place matzot are mentioned in the Bible. Verse 4, they had not yet lain down when the townspeople, Sodomites, converged upon the house. From young to old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. What are they asking for? Bring them out to us so we can basically gang rape them. Excuse my blunt language, but that's exactly what it means. Lot went out to them to the entrance and shut the door behind him. And he said, I beg you, my brothers. So why do you call these men your brothers? How are these men your brothers? Do not act wickedly. Now that gets him in real trouble. You see, people who are invested in immorality cannot stand to hear moral correction. Can't stand it. He says, see now I have two daughters who have never known a man. I shall bring them out to you. You do to them as you please. Now, does the righteous man do this? Some commentators, some of the sages try to excuse Lot and say it's just a figure of speech. Like, take the clothes off my back. Never expect anybody to actually take the clothes off your back. But, you know, it's like, here, take my daughters. Knowing that they wouldn't, because they weren't interested in women. But still, it's a horrible thing to say. I shall bring them out to you and do them as you please. But these men do nothing, inasmuch as they have come under the shadow of my roof. And they said, stand back. Then they said, this fellow came to sojourn and would act as a judge. He's judging us. Because he just said, don't act wickedly. You're judging us. Now we will treat you worse than them. They pressed exceedingly upon the man, upon Lot, and they approached to break the door. You know, in Ezekiel, in other places, it describes the sins of Sodom, but never specifically mentions homosexuality. And here's one of the most specific places, Ezekiel 16, 49 to 50. It says, "Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom." Ezekiel's rebuking the people of Jerusalem because they had sunk into such sin. He says, "You're like Sodom's sisters. She and her daughters, the other cities of the plain, had arrogance," so there's pride, "abundant food," there's no lack of food, "and careless ease," they had so much leisure on their hands. You know, that's a real recipe for falling into immorality. It's a real recipe. And only in cultures where you see these three things do you see homosexuality, which is everywhere, always has been. You see it just spreading and running rampant and taking over the culture. When there's arrogance, abundant food, excess of leisure, then this thing goes like fire. Just goes like fire. It's happened in almost every culture that has since fallen. But she did not help the poor and needy. Thus they were haughty and committed abominations. So notice that the committing of the abominations is based on these three prerequisites. Again, you find immorality everywhere. But usually in a poor society that has to really work, there's not much leisure. But there's humility, where you have to work for your food, you don't take anything for granted. Immorality is kept in control. But when there's lots of free time, lots of abundance, lots of wealth, things we all enjoy, immorality becomes full blown. It takes over a culture and will destroy it. I'll need to spell out for you that this is the danger our nation is in. So many people don't work at all. But in this country, you don't have to worry about it. You'll be taken care of. You'll have food. You'll be taken care of. And I'm not saying we shouldn't take care of people. I'm just saying, though, there was a real danger when people who will not work are taken care of. Now, the Bible says, if a man will not work, neither let him eat. Now, if a person cannot work, take care of them. You got to take care of them. Because not to is to be like Sodom. She did not help the poor and the needy. We have to help the poor and the needy. But when people can work, they need to work. They need to work. Then the passage ends, "Therefore I removed them when I saw it." So Sodom was a place that was just too good for its own good. It was just too easy. The living rivers are too easy. "They pressed exceedingly upon the man, upon Lot, and they approached to break the door. The men stretched out their hand," the two angels stretched out their hand and brought Lot into the house with them and closed the door. "And the men who were at the entrance of the house, they struck with blindness from small to great, and they tried vainly to find the entrance." People who are given over to immorality are always blind. It's almost like a supernatural blindness. It's almost like when a person reaches such a point of immorality, God takes away their ability to become moral. And after all, when a person doesn't have the ability to live morally, he's no longer responsible for his sin. So it's almost an act of mercy. In fact, throughout this destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, God does not call himself Elohim, which is his name of strict justice. What does he call himself? Adonai, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is his name of mercy and tenderness. His destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, throughout the entire thing, he calls himself by the name that designates mercy and indicates mercy, tenderness. Why? Because people have reached this point that's so incorrigible, so beyond hope. It's an act of mercy to stop them from going any further in their sin, heaping more condemnation upon themselves. That kind of goes against our grain, doesn't it? It kind of goes against our grain. Well, that's okay. You and I aren't God. And I don't think we have any judges in here that sit on a bench and have to sometimes condemn people to prison or even to death. I wouldn't want that responsibility. So if it goes against your grain, makes you feel uncomfortable, that's normal. That's okay. But if God should choose that one of you has to sit on a judge's bench and you have to condemn people, then may God give you great wisdom and the ability to make godly decisions, not based on emotions or anything else. And but thank God only God has the final say when this kind of destruction from heaven comes upon the earth. So they bring Lot in. In verse 12, the men said to Lot, "Whom else do you have here? A son-in-law? Your sons? Your daughters?" I keep thinking, no, Abraham had made a deal with God. If he can find 10 righteous people, spare the whole city. It's like these angels are there saying, okay, who else you got here? Can we get 10 people together? They couldn't. I'm not so sure about Lot himself if he was a righteous man. But Peter says he was, so I can't argue with Peter. He says, "All that you have in the city, remove from the place, for we are about to destroy this place, for their outcry has become great before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Adonai. So Adonai has sent us to destroy it. The God of mercy has sent us to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah." Verse 14, "So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law." Now get this. "And the betrothed of his daughters," So his two daughters have these fiancés. So they're called sons-in-law because when you're betrothed, you're legally married, though you don't cohabit. "And he said, 'Get up and leave this place, for Adonai is about to destroy the city.' But he seemed like a mocker, a jester in the eyes of his sons-in-law." The word zakak, which means to laugh, is the heart of this word. It means jester, one who makes people laugh. Lot, by being in the position he was in, by choosing to live in Sodom, had lost all of his credibility when it came to speaking truth from God. He had truth to speak. The words he spoke were absolutely true. But he had lost his credibility. You ever wonder why sometimes when you speak truth, you don't have credibility with people? Sometimes it's because they just can't hear the truth. But you need to investigate your own heart and ask yourself, have I lost credibility? Am I trying to speak truth to someone who in the past I've only talked to about sports or about TV shows or about things that just don't matter? So now when I come to speak something truly profound, it's like, who do you think you are? God convicts me about this every time I read this sentence. Because I tend to be a jester. I love jesting and joking and laughing and making people laugh. But then God says, Grant, I want to use that mouth for other things as well. If you invest it all in just making people laugh, what happens when you want to make people serious? Will you have any credibility with them? And that bothers me. It really does. He was like a jester. So they basically blew him off, and like, you do what you want to do, but we're not going anywhere. Verse 15, "And just as dawn was breaking, the angels hurried Lot on, saying, 'Get up, take your wife and your two daughters who are present, lest you be swept away because of the sin of the city.' Still he lingered. So the men grasped him by his hand, his wife's hand, and the hand of his two daughters, and Adonai's mercy on him, and they took him out and left him outside the city. And it was as they took them out that one said, 'Flee for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stop anywhere in the plain.'" You know, when I saw that, "don't stop anywhere in the plain," I was reminded of Genesis 13:10. Remember when Abraham told Lot, says, "Listen, you know, your herds are my herds, your herds are my herds, but they're not getting along too well. We need to split up." So he tells Lot, says, "Listen, if you decide to go to the north, I'll go to the south. If you want to go to the south, I'll go to the north. Go one or the other." And Lot looks east and says, "I think I'll go that way, down to Sodom." And this is what it says. "Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain." That's the same term used here, where the angels tell him, "Do not look behind you nor stop anywhere in all the plain." And in fact, you've got to leave the plain that looked so attractive to you before. You got to get out of here. This is not a place. This was not an option for you to live here. "He saw all the plain of the Jordan that was well watered everywhere. This was before Adonai destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like the garden of Adonai, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot followed his eyes. You know, Lot always wanted to follow what was comfortable, what was easy. Always wanted to take like the gentle downward slope. Ah, I just kind of coast. I love to coast. But we're, like C.S. Lewis wrote, we're called to go further up and further in. And you can't just follow gravity. You can't let gravity be your guide. You have to resist it and keep moving up towards him. And then he says, don't go over the plain, but flee to the mountain. The mountain, what is the mountain? You know what the mountain is? The mountain where Abraham was all along. Go back to where you're supposed to have been. Then choose north or south. Go back to the mountain. That's where Abraham is. At the end of the chapter, we see Abraham up on the mountain looking down, watching Sodom and Gomorrah go up in smoke. Go to the mountain. But what does Lot say? Verse 18. Please, no, my Lord. Now, how can you say no to your master? You don't say no to your master. If you say no to your master, he's not your master anymore. When your master speaks, you say yes. But Lot says, oh, no. But then he has to butter them up. Oh, my Lord, my master, you're my master. But, oh, please, not this. You know, the person who's so passive like Lot, he always takes the easy way. They always think they have a better idea than God does. They always think their idea is better. They really don't think God understands my limitations. Anyone who says no to God is saying, God, you don't know me. And he's like, I made you. Look at Moses. You know, when God called Moses the burning bush. Yeah, Moses is making all these excuses. Oh, I don't talk good. He says, well, who made your mouth? And he makes this, well, they won't believe me. Oh, okay, let me give some things, they'll believe these. And finally he says, send somebody else. And then God got angry. But whenever God calls you to do something, he puts it on your heart to do something, that means he's equipping you to do it. Remember, God doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called. And so if he says, this is for you to do, run it by some people, some mentors, some people who you respect, and make sure you're hearing things right. And if you are, then quit asking questions. Do it. Because if you don't, you're going to be miserable. And boy, does Lot end up a miserable life. Verse 19. See now, your servant has found grace in your eyes, and your kindness was great, which you did with me to save my life. But I cannot escape to the mountain, lest the evil attach itself to me and I die. In other words, I don't think I make it all the way up there. I'm not going to get far enough, and then the destruction will get me. Some might call a whambulance. You know, it's just whining. It's like, ugh. But you know, God doesn't tend to make us do things we're not willing to do. If you're not going to do it, okay. You know, I always say you can do in this life whatever you want. When people say, do I have to do this? The Bible says, no, you don't have to do it. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to do anything. You can do whatever you want with your life. That's the scary thing about living in this world. You can live your life however you want to live it. And I promise you, no matter how you live your life, you'll justify it. If you have a spiritual core at all, you'll just find something in God's word to justify how you've chosen to live your life. But these are not the people who truly have God as their Lord. These are the people like Lot. So be careful how you choose. Know what to want. Know what to choose. Choose wisely. Because God will let you choose whatever you want to do. So when Lot whines and says, oh, it's too far, it's too hard, too tough, I can't do it. In verse 20, he makes a suggestion. Behold, please, this city is near enough to escape there, and it's Matzor. It's small, it's little. It's just a little town. And if I flee, I shall flee there. Is it not Matzor? Isn't it just a little tiny town? You can spare that one little town. Let me go there and I will live. So what did the angel say? Behold, I have granted you consideration regarding this thing, that I not overturn the city about which you have spoken. See, Zoar was also marked for destruction, but they spare it for Lot's sake. Hurry, flee there, for I cannot do a thing until you arrive there. He therefore called the name of the city Zoar, little. The sun rose upon the earth, and Lot arrived at Zoar. Now Adonai had caused sulfur and fire to rain upon Sodom and Gomorrah from Adonai out of heaven. It's kind of interesting. I want you to rethink the next time you hear the term fire and brimstone sermon. I heard it. That guy just preached fire and brimstone. Now when someone preaches fire and brimstone, what are they talking about? Hell. But the only place you find fire and brimstone, it comes out of heaven. That should turn your brain right side up. Yeah, it comes from Adonai, out of heaven. He overturned these cities and the entire plain with all the inhabitants of the cities and the vegetation of the soil. But his wife peered behind him and she became a pillar of salt. Let's look at that. That's always been kind of a conundrum, hasn't it? His wife looked behind from behind him and she became a pillar of salt. And in Hebrew, it's Nitziv Malak. Now, this word malak is not the word melek, king. It sounds very similar, but the word malak, spelled this way, is salt. That's the word for salt right there, malak. But this word netziv is interesting. It's found 13 times in the Bible. Only here is referred to a pillar. Ah, so what are the other 12 times? The other 12 times is found, it refers to a garrison of soldiers, a guard post, someone who's in command to kind of put up the limits, like, okay, this is, you have to stop here. We have to do some inspection. And this is where things end, right here. Before we let you go past, we have to check things out. That's what the word netziv means. She became a netziv of salt. What's that all about? And also the word salt, you have to understand, in the Bible and in the entire Middle East, and especially the ancient Middle East, salt was always a symbol of things that endure forever. I've been reading a book about the covenant of salt. And it talks about, in all these different cultures, how once you eat salt that belongs to somebody else, you can never betray them. You must always be loyal to them. In fact, if you've ever read the Arabian Nights, the stories about the Arabian Nights. There's a whole bunch of them, hundreds of stories. In one of those stories, a burglar, a thief, gets into the king's treasure house. He gets into the palace, he picks the locks, he's a cat burglar. He gets down to the treasure house, and it's all dark in there. And he's picking up jewels and this and that. And after he had so many jewels he couldn't carry anymore, his toe bumped against another jewel. And he thought, what do I do with that? So he picked it up and just stuck it in his mouth to carry it. When he stuck it in his mouth, he tasted it. It wasn't a jewel at all. It was a salt crystal. And when he tasted that salt crystal, just, ugh. He took all the jewels out of his pockets, now the bags, put them all back down. And the next day, the king found out somebody had been in his treasure house, but nothing had been stolen. So he calls everybody around and says, who is in my treasure house? What were you doing there? Just come forward and give an explanation. Nothing was stolen, but what did you do? And finally, the thief comes forward. He says, I was there. He says, I was there to steal as much as I could, but the moment I accidentally tasted your salt, I could no longer steal from you. Because I've tasted your salt. And so the king smiled and he made him his right-hand man. Anyone who's going to be this loyal to the principle of the salt covenant, then I can trust him. And he became his right-hand man, his trusted confidant. And there are many, many examples of this. And so she became a netziv of salt. A guard post, like a garrison, something that's there all the time. What does this mean? I think that when God inspired Moses to write these words in this way, he was looking ahead to what the Messiah would say in Luke 17:32. Remember Lot's wife. We don't even know her name. But by saying remember, This says, this is something that goes on forever, and this is a guard post for you. This is a sentry. It's asking, what are you doing here? Who are you? Where are you going? What's your business? And so Lot's wife is an eternal reminder to us to ask ourselves, where are we? What are we doing? What do we think we're doing? We call it, you think we're following God, but our hearts are back there? Really? And Yeshua says, remember Lot's wife. She was destined for survival, for rescue. She didn't make it. She was on her way out. She didn't make it. And Yeshua says, remember her. In fact, she is the only individual from the entire Tanakh. Yeshua commands us to remember. Now, he wants us to remember all of them, but he specifically singles out this nameless woman, say, remember her. That's because she's a warning. She's the guard post that warns you. Where are you going? What are you doing here? And she's become an eternal guardian of that question for us in our day. I think that's what the Nazir Malach means. It's an eternal guard post, an eternal reminder to ask ourselves, what are you doing? Well, anyways, moving on. Where do we leave off? Okay, verse 27. Abraham, shifting back up to the mountain, Abraham rose early in the morning to the place where he had stood before Adonai. And he gazed down upon Sodom and Gomorrah and the entire surface of the land of the plain and saw, and behold, the smoke of the earth rose like the smoke of a kiln. Now see, now Lot and his wife and family are not allowed to look back at Sodom's destruction. But Abraham was allowed. There's a principle here. The sages say that only one who is truly righteous is allowed to look down upon the destruction of the wicked. So you're not truly righteous. God says, don't you look. Because that could very easily be you. But the righteous, the truly righteous, they're going to be allowed to view the destruction of the wicked. Okay, let's get a microphone over to Carl. I see Carl's hand up. So. Oh, what was that?
Doesn't it have something to do with Psalm 91? You will appeal with your eyes and see the punishment of the wicked.
I'm sure.
If you conditionally.
Yes. Probably Psalm 91 is based on this story. Yes, yes. Good point. Good observation. So, anyways, he gazed down, he sees the destruction. Verse 29, and so it was when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham. So he sent Lot from amidst the upheaval when he overturned the cities in which Lot had lived. Now Lot went up from Zoar and settled on the mountain. In fact, he even left Zoar. I think when he saw the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and realized what happened, he started getting afraid, Zoar is destined for that too. And they're so rotten, it's a matter of time for God does the same here. I'm going to keep moving on. Fear just motivated him. Every decision he made was motivated by fear or his own self-comfort. And so he leaves Zoar, his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to remain in Zoar. Here's something to remember. Every decision you make based on fear will lead to more fear. Every decision you make based on fear will lead to more fear. Guaranteed. It's a principle I've discovered in my life, and I've observed it in the lives of others. But when a person makes a decision and decides, fear is not going to be part of the formula for me making this decision, I often counsel people, and they don't know what to do. I say, well, if you had absolute total courage, you were a totally fearless person, you were all the Avengers rolled into one, what would you do? Oh, well, I would do such and such. I say, okay, pretend you have no fear. Pretend you're that man and do that thing. That's how simple it is. So when people operate out of courage, they become more courageous. You operate out of fear, you become more fearful because you're feeding the monkey in your back. You're feeding the addiction to fear. So the girls come up with a plot. Verse 31, the older one said to the younger, our father is old, and there is no man in the land to marry us in the usual manner. Come, let us ply our father with wine and lay with him, that we may give life to offspring through our father. You know, going way back to chapter 13, where Lot chose to go live in Sodom and Gomorrah, if he could have looked into the future and see what his two daughters were going to do, do you think he would have made that same choice? Here's a warning to you. The choices you make for your own comfort, the choices you make out of fear now, will have a profound negative impact on your children and grandchildren. They really will. Set a tone of courage. Set a tone, men, of being men. Women, set a tone of being women. Do the right thing. Live life right, because you're being watched. You're being watched. And if you could see the effect your life has on your kids, I think we would maybe change some things that we're doing. So, verse 32, come let us ply our father with wine, lay with him that we may give life to offspring through our father. So they plied their father with wine on that night. The older one came and lay with her father. And he was not aware of her lying down or of her getting up. What does this remind you of? There's been deliverance from a great destruction. And then you're getting drunk in your tent, in this case a cave, and then your kids do something rotten. What does this remind you of? Noah. So what do you think you need to do? Take the story of Noah and his sons and the story of Lot and his daughters and lay them side by side, make a menorah, and see what God brings out of that. See how this works? See how you use the Torah to comment on the Torah and to bring out these menorah truths? I wish we had time to do that this morning. We don't. And it was on the next day. Oh, by the way, that word and her getting up, it's kind of interesting. This is the word. It's uvkuma, and in the Torah scrolls, if we opened up our Torah scroll, it would look like this. There's the word, and there's this dot right there. That is not a vowel point. That's a dot that's in every single Torah scroll on this word in this verse. And the sages tell us that dot represents that little tiny itsy-bitsy seed that she didn't have when she lay down. But now when she got up, the seed was with her. The seed from her father. Now, the next night, the younger does the same thing, and she gets up. And then it says in verse 37, the older bore a son, and she called his name Moav. It's a V sound, Moav. Now, what does the word Av mean? Father. So Moav means from father, because her son was from father. And that's where you get the name Moav, or Moab. The Moabites. And who's the most famous Moabite in the Bible? Ruth. Ruth, the Moabite. That little dot contains Ruth. And Ruth was the great-grandmother of who? David. David's in that little dot. And David is the ancestor of who? Messiah. He's in that little dot. Don't ever underestimate the power of tiny things, right? Seriously. And what's amazing is that God could use this horrible, incestuous thing that's the result of Lot's terrible decisions, his terrible child rearing, his daughter's horrible choices, and out of all of that disaster, God brings forth the likes of a Ruth, a David, a Solomon, Yeshua. What other God does things like that? That's the kind of God you can really trust and just abandon your soul to follow. And then the younger sister, she also gives birth, and she names her son Ben-Ami. Now, what does Ben mean? Son or son of, and Am is father. Ami means my father, or people, and Ami means my people, so son of my people. So from father and son of my people. These are the heads of the Moabites and the Ammonites, who were for the most part terrible enemies of Israel. So there's always bad that comes out of it, but God out of that brings good as well. So we started this talking about righteousness. How is Lot considered a righteous man in light of this? And you can go back to chapter 13. He wasn't as messed up there, but he still made stupid decisions. And we're done with Lot in the book of Genesis. We don't see him anymore after this. How is he a righteous man? Well, it has made me think. I've come up with these terms. Maybe someone else has invented them as well, but I haven't heard them if they have. And I call it passive righteousness and active righteousness. And the first place you find the word righteousness, tzedakah. Now you find the word righteous, tzedek, you find that earlier. But the noun, tzedakah, righteousness, the first time you find it, is applied to Abraham in Genesis 15:6. You know the story? Abraham has done some things with the Lord, and he's rescued his nephew Lot once already from the kings that attacked Sodom. And he's been walking with God a little bit. And at one point, God takes him outside, says, "Why don't you look up at the stars? You see them? Can you count them? Wow, look at all those stars." He says, "Abram, this is what your children are going to be like. This is how many kids you're going to have." And it says, then he believed in Adonai, and he counted it to him as righteousness. There's the first time righteousness is found in the Bible. What did Abraham do for this to be accounted as righteousness? Nothing. He looked up, said, "Okay, I believe you." Totally passive. The next time you find the word righteousness is in last week's chapter. It's when the angels are getting ready to go to Sodom, and then they say, "Shouldn't we reveal to Abraham what we're about to do? We are in blood covenant with him. God's saying I'm in blood covenant. Shouldn't I share with him what I'm about to do?" And then last week we saw how we got, or 2 weeks ago, how we got this little glimpse into God's mind. And this is what God says, "For I have chosen him so that he may command his children." I've chosen him so that he may do something, so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of Adonai by doing righteousness. God, that I've chosen him so that he will command and teach his children's household to keep the way of the Lord. How? By doing tzedakah, by doing righteousness and justice, so that Adonai may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. It makes a complete circle. But this is active righteousness. This is righteousness that comes from Abraham doing something, commanding his children, teaching them and his household and how to walk in the way of Adonai, of doing the things God gave him to do. So we see it passive in the first appearance, active in the second. But with Lot, all I see is passive righteousness. You know, passively righteous people, they're content with just not doing bad stuff. They're not so excited about actually actively pursuing righteousness. And what are we commanded by the Messiah? Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Seek that. Job number one. Then all this other stuff is added to you. But Lot decided, "I'm going to pursue all the other stuff and just be sure not to do anything wicked and evil." He was content in just not being bad, but he did not actively pursue doing right. You know, when you go to chapter 18, this is really amazing. When the angels appear to Abraham, it says he ran to them. And then it says he told Sarah, "Hurry, make some bread." Then he runs to the field and tells the youth, "Slay, you know, kill this lamb and get all ready." Then he runs there. Five times you see him rushing, hurrying, running. Five times. Then you come to chapter 19. And five times you see the angels rushing Lot, hurrying Lot, urging him, "Hurry, run, flee." Five times, exactly five. And in the Hebrew, they just jump out at you. Abraham was actively pursuing righteousness. He ran to them. He ran. He wanted to do good. But Lot had to be urged five times. He was so just kind of complacent. "I'm just content where I'm at." So how could God call him righteous? I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe simply because he's related to Abraham. Maybe his righteousness is somehow just rubbed off. And because he's connected to Abraham, he's called righteous. I don't know. When it comes to God's idea of righteousness, I don't understand it. It's like righteousness like water. You go to pick it up and it just runs out of your hands. You can't get a grasp on what it is. And I can understand how God decides who's righteous and who isn't. I'm not God. And he's the one who determines what righteousness is and what the standard of righteousness is. I don't quite get it. Don't understand it. But boy, I'm so hopeful. If Lot can be called righteous, and I don't seem to do him anything right. Maybe there's hope for all of us. But I don't want to be passive. I don't want to be passive. I want to be an Abraham. You know, I there are a number of people throughout history and people you may know who named their sons Abraham. How many of you know of sons named Lot? Can you imagine our 16th president being named Lot Lincoln? Right? It ain't going to happen. Nobody emulates Lot. Nobody wants to be like Lot. Lot is not an example of what to be like. Righteous or not, Abraham is. Abraham is the father of us all. We walk in his steps, we're his children. I want to be a son of Abraham, not a nephew. You understand? I want to move on because our time is limited. Now, remember that back in Genesis 15, this is four chapters earlier. God shows Abraham the stars, says, count them if you can. That's what your children will be like. God, Abraham believed God and counted them as righteousness. But I want you to see what James says. Now, James knew the Torah inside out. James is Yeshua's brother. Listen to what he says. This is kind of a mind blower. It says, was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar? Now, when does that happen? That happens in chapter 22. We're getting there. We have three chapters to go. You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. Are you ready? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Wait a minute, James. God didn't say that when Abraham offered up Isaac in chapter 22. He said it way back in chapter 15 when Abraham wasn't doing squat, except looking at the stars. So why does God tell Abraham back in chapter 15 that because Abraham believed God when he looked at the stars, he counted him as righteousness, but James says, oh no, it's fulfilled up here in chapter 22 when he offers his son. Again, I don't understand righteousness, but there seems to be a timelessness about God's way of seeing righteousness. He says, I called Abraham because he will command his children. I called him because he will. And he'll teach them to walk in the ways of Adonai. And when he does, then I can bring on the things I've already promised. There's this timelessness with the way God looks at things. It's almost like he can call someone righteous now because of what they're going to do. I don't get it. But see, I'm not the arbiter of what's righteous and what's not. He is. Only he is. He is the righteous one. And only he can make the determination. Deuteronomy 6:25 says it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all his commandments before Adonai our God, just as he commanded us. Now here's a way you can be sure of being a righteous person. By keeping his commandments, observing them before Adonai your God. But do it in the way he commanded. Do it out of love for him. Not out of legalism, out of love. Out of love. Another well-known passage. You know, you always hear the passage, the righteous man shall live by his faith. That's not quite how it's put in Hebrew. Here it is, Habakkuk 2:4. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul's not right within him. But the righteous man, according to his faith, he will live. That makes a lot more sense. But Zadik, the righteous man, there's the word amunah. That's a word for faith. We get the word amen from that. Ba means with, in, according to. The righteous man, according to his faith, yechia. There's the word chai, which means life. This is the verb form, will live. In other words, the righteous man believes, and what he believes is what controls what he does. There's no question Lot believed, but he didn't act on it. He didn't live by his faith. He didn't live according to his faith. I'm sure he believed in one God just like Abraham did. I'm sure he believed all the idols were just just phantoms. They were just nothings, just like Abraham believed. But Abraham lived according to his faith, and Lot didn't. And here we're told that the righteous man, the truly righteous man, according to his faith, he's going to live. What's your faith? All right, now live it. Live it. Demons believe, right? They tremble. I don't want demonic faith. I want real faith. Which brings up the topic of discipleship. And I want to finish with this. You know, this week, I sent out the announcement yesterday about our five groups that are starting. And hopefully, a year from now, there'll be a dozen or more groups going. Discipleship. I want us to understand what discipleship is. Discipleship is not a Christian invention. It's a very ancient Jewish one that is still alive and well today in the Jewish community. Moses Maimonides, who lived, how long ago? 600-700 years ago. He said, every person in Israel is obligated to be engaged in Torah learning, whether one is poor or wealthy, whether one is whole in body or afflicted with suffering, whether one is young or one is old and feeble, even a poor person who is supported by charity and goes from door to door seeking benevolence, even the man supporting his wife and children, everyone is required to find a set time during the day and the night to study Torah, study the Word of God. As it was said, you shall go over it again and again and again and again and again and again, day and night. That's Grant's amplified version of Joshua 1:8. That's discipleship. And these discipleship groups, unlike so many other discipleship groups, we're not interested in just developing the head of a disciple. We want to develop the heart of a disciple. And the heart of a disciple is one who has a master. And our rabbi, our master, is Yeshua HaMashiach. And he is our rabbi, and we are to model every detail of our life after him. And I shared this information back when we were doing Matthew 3 years ago. And these are the things that discipleship engage and include. One is a radical call to a mentoring relationship. Yeshua said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he can't be my disciple. In other words, he's saying, okay, you want to be my disciple? What happens if one of your parents gets in the way and says, no, don't do that. Who you pick, me or your parents? Let's say your kids, your wife, your husband says, oh, come on, he's up on that stuff. You don't have time to do those commandments. Yeah, come on. Which one do you pick? The disciple picks Yeshua every single time. Now, we'll do it in a wise and sensitive way when we respond to people who discourage us. You don't turn around and say, I love Jesus, I hate you. Yeah, that's not how you do it. It's not how you handle it. But what it's saying is your love for him should be so great that when anything interferes with that, it should almost be like hatred because you hate what they're trying to get you to do. And that's to move away from following your rabbi, who is Yeshua. Yeshua, he tells Peter, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed to you my Father in heaven. What happens the moment Peter starts to think like a man? Say, oh, Yeshua, we don't want you to suffer and die on the cross. Get behind me, Satan. You savor the things of men, not of God. See, there's this verse lived out. He loved Peter. Loved him with all his heart. But the moment Peter started getting in the way of Yeshua following his father, he became a Satan. Satan means to oppose. He became an opposer, and he called him that. Quit opposing to me. This is what my father's called me to do. Don't you dare get in the way of this. That's the attitude you must have towards anyone, no matter how much you love them, when they get in the way of you following your rabbi, Yeshua. Number two, demanded obedience. Rabbis demand obedience. Now, if you don't want to obey, okay, fine. You're not my disciple anymore. You want to be my disciple? You must do what I tell you. Yeshua said, You are my friends if you what? Do what I command you. See, we want to be Yeshua's friend, but do what we want. It doesn't work that way. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them, that's the key, and does them, will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. We have to do his words. And he tells his disciples, go therefore and make disciples of all nations. Teach them to obey all that I've commanded you. Here's one way to test if you're a disciple. Are you making disciples? If you're not, guess what? You're not a disciple. Period. Not my rule. That's my rabbi's rule. Are you making disciples? No, you're not a disciple. Making disciples? Good. Now, you may be a disciple. How are you doing? What kind of disciples are you making? You making disciples of you or disciples of him? And is it the biblical version of Yeshua you're making disciples of, or some watered-down, weird kind of religious version of Yeshua you're making disciples of? If you're not making disciples, you are not a disciple. 3, they learn by observation. They expected to conduct themselves, they were expected to conduct themselves like their rabbi. And every decision they made, they would be, okay, what did Yeshua teach about this? What was the example he set? What did he teach? How do we do this? I remember listening to Ray Vanderlaan share about taking classes in Jerusalem. And one of his professors was Dr. David Flusser, who's an Orthodox Jew, but an expert on the New Testament. And in this university, Dr. Flusser was teaching about the New Testament to mostly Jews who don't believe in Yeshua, but teaching them this is what the New Testament scriptures say. And he got to talk about discipleship. And you could tell Dr. Flusser did not have a very high opinion of most discipleship he'd seen in the church. This is what he said. Any Christian that tells me he is a disciple of Jesus but does not read the 4 Gospels at least once a month is a liar. Because you see, in Judaism, if you're a disciple of a rabbi, you devour his words, you memorize his words, you live according to his words, you follow his example. That is your entire focus in life. But we Christians have been pretty sloppy about how we claim discipleship. Now, I'm not saying, don't condemn yourself. I'm just saying, this is the standard Flusser puts on discipleship. This is the standard he said. If you want Christian discipleship to be on the level of Jewish discipleship, then this is the level. This is it. So you can take this or leave it, but chew on that. I'm going to finish with a story. I heard Ray Vanderlaan share this first, and I've since come across it and another source is a very old story about Rabbi Akiva. He lived in the first century. He may have been a child when Yeshua was alive, and Akiva lived in Capernaum, the city of Yeshua, which is right on the northern edge of the Sea of Galilee. Rabbi Akiva was a genius. And one late afternoon, near evening, he's walking home, and he's always so deep in thought. He was so deep in thought, he passed up his street. And he just kept on walking. He's walking, just thinking and walking and thinking and walking. Finally, he hears this booming voice say, "Who are you? And why are you here?" And he shakes him out of his thoughts. And he looks up, and it's the Roman garrison. There was a Roman garrison in Capernaum, and he's there at the guard station up on the top is this soldier. And Akiva says, "What did you say?" And the soldier said, "Who are you? And why are you here?" And Akiva thinks for a second and says, "How much are they paying you to do this?" And now the soldier is surprised. He says, "Well, they pay me 4 drachmas a week to do this." Akiva says, "I'll pay you twice as much if you come to my house every morning and ask me these 2 questions." See, Lot didn't know who he was or what he was doing. He had no idea. He just followed his own comfort. Abraham knew who he was. He knew what he was doing. Which one was a disciple of the Father? Got it? So who are you? What are you doing? Does what you do really matter for eternity? Does it even matter for a long time what you do? Will it matter years from now what you're doing now? So who are you? Because your existence here is coming to an end. Okay? There is a funeral in your future, and it'll be your name on the casket, right? It'll be your body in the box. That'll be you. After that, no coming back. That's it. Your work's done. It's pointed out that a man wants to die after this, the what? The judgment. All right. It's time for the report card. Let's look at your life. This is your life. And it's all played back. Like Lot's is played back, like Abraham's is played back, like yours and mine will be played back. So the question is, while you have time, who are you? What are you doing here? Right? If you've signed up for one of these discipleship classes and you're not ready for this level of commitment to the rabbi, Yeshua, then tell you what, if you're really not ready to do that, I'm going to ask you to go to your leader and say, you know what, I'm going to ask you to take my name off for now, because I need to wrestle through some things. But if you're really serious about becoming a disciple of the Master, then sign up. And if the lists are full, then be the first one to get on the list next time these classes come around. Because this is the level of discipleship we want here at Beth Tikkun. It's what I want for my life, okay? And this is what we want to be. Good? You're right? Are we all on the same page? All right, let's close in prayer then. Father, thank you for this time together. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the example of Lot. And Lord, if nothing else, maybe Lot will get praise for this life that is so instructive to us. And because it serves as a warning to us. And it serves as a goad to spur us on to follow hard after you. So Father, if I know that happens in our lives, so I pray you'd reward Lot for that. But Lord, I pray you'd help us to be more like an Abraham. Help us to be like him, to be his children, to walk in his steps. Most of all, help us to be like Yeshua. Help us to redouble our commitment to take life seriously, to know who we are, to know what we're doing here, because our time here is so short. And we'll give you all the praise and glory for it in Yeshua's precious name. Amen.